Welcome to the free MP3 sampler of Dr. Frisch's distance learning courses. Dr. Frisch has been training in Wilhelm Reich's theoretical and clinical approach for decades and has developed her own method that includes the basics of setting up the patient relationship, a comprehensive view of the therapeutic relationship from start to completion, a clear diagnostic typology for understanding character, and finally, an analytic template of somatic interventions with patients. We have compiled 7 samples, mainly lectures from her introductory, intermediate, advanced courses, and comprehensive course, now on CDs for your listening pleasure. We have included an experiential segment to bring in the lively class interactions and practicum training offered on Dr. Frisch's CDs. Please listen and learn, enjoying the variety of lecture material offered in her CD collections. Her audio courses are available for distant learning CE credits. Welcome to Dr. Frisch's Interventions, the Therapist's Tool Chest, Intermediate CD course.
I'm going to move rather quickly just through some other intervention points and tools so that you just kind of can keep them in mind. And I've gone over these before, more or less. One is, of course, your intervention palette really has to do with your ability to diagnose, which is why I spend a lot of time on character diagnosis, endless time on character diagnosis, because if you can see who you're working with clearly, your intervention style, although fluid and creative, also is always aware of who you're working with, and that's really helpful. And so do your differential, do your work of differential. Learn to do that quickly and diagnose well. So we'll talk a little bit about interpretation with predominantly with narcissistic personality disorders, either phallic or pregenital. In other words, looking with the two paradigms I've taught you. Reich's paradigm of phallic narcissist, male or female, and all of those types, or disorder of the self. But basically, we can use the mirroring interpretation with narcissists, especially early on in treatment, to try to get them into their vulnerability. Later, Reich used confrontation with all character types at all times, but especially for pregenital disorder of the self narcissists who are less developmentally sound or advanced, they almost can't tolerate a confrontation till later in the treatment when you can pretty well say anything. If you confront a disorder of the self narcissist, they'll split on you and they'll bolt. In other words, they can't integrate it and they will feel very offended and they will see you as an attacking object. And they will get all convoluted in their split and in seeing you that way. And you can lose them and it really stops the treatment from progressing. So it is better to constantly interpret their reactions to things that you say, such that you can say, when I said that, you seemed to get upset. Or you can say with your authority, I noticed when you felt misunderstood, you know, you reacted with outrage. But I can really see you were hurting underneath. You know, can you tell me what happened between us? Or when this happens with your boss, it seems you feel so vulnerable. Or when he looks at you this way, you get frightened. You know, so you're interpreting what is going on in the person's world and interpreting the deeper issue. I have one narcissistic male, actually he's a schizoid with a narcissistic overlay, but his narcissism is really strong. And he interprets everything all day long as a threat to his ego, you know, as if he is not doing a good job or he'll be fired. And I interpret so that he can keep seeing his exquisite sensitivity to rejection. Narcissists are exquisitely sensitive to rejection and criticism. They can barely stand it. The stronger narcissists, the phallic narcissists, the neurotic narcissists, I'm stopping a minute because most of them have some splitting, but they're stronger and they can take it and they'll just attack you back. And they'll use their brilliance, if they happen to have it, to debate you. And they'll debate ad nauseum, and they'll catch you up with what you said and refute you, and you're playing that game. And that's what you do with a lot of that. And then you got to just somehow get under it with interpretation. So if they're less aggressive, you can still feel their distancing and tension in the room, and you try to interpret that. When I said this, you seem to go away. What happened? Interpret their disappointment with you, because they're always disappointed in you. You never do it right. You don't mirror them well. You're never fused enough. You're never good enough. And you have to keep your eye on that. They're very sensitive to how you mirror them. If you're off a nuance, they're not pleased. And don't, you know, go forward without really capturing that. And then you'll be with a narcissist, you'll be getting along just fine for a long, long time. Work is proceeding, and all of a sudden something will happen where they will go into such a deep, defective split that they reject you. Boom. And then you have to keep them in the therapy. That's happened to me with narcissists that I've worked with for 2 and 3 years. If they go into a crisis with you in a given situation, they can want to terminate. I've had enough. I'm done with therapy. It'll bring up all of their negativity because they have a lot of self-loathing and self-hate. So you always have to watch for that. Don't be surprised. But as the therapy goes along and there's a therapeutic alliance, you can use more confrontation with narcissists. Don't be afraid of that. But sometimes it's a knockdown fight. You got to really get in there and wrestle. Because if you don't wrestle, they're gone. And this particular person has advanced incredibly after doing it. I would say, I think I could have lost that patient 3 times. Now, he's finally turning the corner on it, but it took like, you gotta know how important it is for patients to stay in therapy when the going gets tough, for patients not to believe their resistance, for patients not to buy in to their rationalizations, and you keep them. And if you can contain them, that it's a whole different therapy after that. They've gone to the next level, and they're better than they've ever been in their entire life. But you have to, you just fight it out sometimes. They say that, you say that's, you don't think that's right. This is what you see. No, that's not right. I mean, and you go through this. But they also see you care. And that you're engaged and involved, and that means something too. That you have the energy to fight them, to fight down their resistances. Remember that trust can evaporate quickly and you can be seen as the devaluing object. Always remember, you've never won anyone over because we're all very injured in terms of trust. So always remember that you can be seen in a very dark light, because trust is rarely fully accomplished. because that's a huge thing to have inside of yourself, is basic trust. Given how most people are raised in the society and the world as we live in it, trust is very hard to come by. We're asking a huge thing out of a patient. It's earned, and it takes a long time, and a lot of times, given people's history, they don't have the receptor sites for it. And so they're almost like having to make new growth neurologically to trust. And at any time, they can slip into the other compartments where trust doesn't live. And then suddenly you're awful looking. And that's part of the work. So you understand kind of perfect mirroring and that whole issue with narcissism, and often what they're looking for, especially very low developed narcissists are definitely looking for perfect mirroring. They are not looking for criticism. They can't stand it. Anything that reeks of criticism, they just cannot, they can't even stand it. They're allergic. So if they bristle, they may have taken something as criticism that was for you, just feedback. And they love to be perfectly mirrored, but don't do it for long, not too long.
Welcome to Dr. Frisch's Incorporating Masterson with Reich, MCEP course.
This morning's lecture is more of an introduction to the Masterson approach, because I spent a lot of time with Reich last session. So I want just to give you that overview so that you understand this aspect of what we're training. And again, as you listen to this, think about your work, because it's, again, not out here, it's in here, because these are deep developmental issues that we're talking about. As I've said many times, like the analyst of his time, Reich saw the etiology of character disorders as originating out of the Oedipal complex. Instincts and drives were what analysts talked about, and still do. And again, as everybody understands, the notions that Freud set down, the id, the ego, and the superego, those were the dynamics. And all behavior, including symptoms, represented kind of this compromise solution between this id, this driving instinctual impulse, and the ego, and the superego, you know, the collective mandate embodied in the superego. So the analyst for years saw this as a one-person psychology, resolving, what do you do with your impulses? You mediate them with the ego, and you mediate them with the superego. And you have this, you know, dialectic and kind of resolving conflict and resolution. And then Reich, of course, extended Freud's work, because he really started understanding character, and he understood the functional impairments in the physical body. So he understood that the sexuality was more than just a frustrated instinct and libido, but that it actually had an economic, energetic function, which he understood with the orgasm function. So Reich took this to the next step profoundly, and then developed an entire therapy on how to work with the somatic blocks to the release of that energy. And developed a system of diagnosis that located the areas of fixation in the body developmentally and created a diagnosis out of it. So you can see how profound Reich was in extending kind of a basic frame of analysis with instinct issues and neurotic sexual Oedipal issues into a very understanding of diagnosis. He extended it way out. So again, like the Freudian analysts of his time, they were focused on the sexual development around the ages of 4 and 5. Oedipal difficulty. And these are examples of neurotic conflict that occur after the age of 3 and the development of full object relations. So when you're looking at patients, this is what I want you guys to start looking at. where is the developmental arrest? And it's not black and white. It's very, very complicated. And it takes very deep understanding of the patient and the transference and the resistance to really peer in to get a feel for where the arrest is. I'm going to present these. I want you to see things on a spectrum so that you can work with this material not in a rigid way. So, with the emergence of the genital function occurs in the phallic phase around the age of 4. So according to Wright, and I want you guys to really understand this, any character type that develops to the phallic phase is considered neurotic. Even if they've given up the phallic level and returned to earlier fixation. So most of Wright's neurotic character types have particular blocks in major erogenous zones of development, pre-genital blocks. And you'll see this chart that Dick has created, and you may have an idea of this in Baker. The phallic level, the what's beyond it is the genital character, which is fully phallic, and genital, fully genital. So that's health for Wright. Somebody may look like they've developed to the phallic level, and then you could call them neurotic. And even Masterson, this gets a little bit foggy, how you define a neurotic versus a disorder of the self. Masterson talked about that. You'll see neurotics and then you'll see disorders of the self. And sometimes it's very difficult to tell. You have to go very deep into the transference to see if somebody has a disorder of the self. And he used that criteria, which I'll go over, whole object relations. During Wright's time, they didn't understand, they didn't do the research on ages 3 and back in terms of attachment disorders. Mm-hmm. So what they called them were infantile characters. And they, you know, Reich had just a clump category for infantile oral characters. And they're not, and as you read it, not much is said. It's like they're brought into therapy by their mother or something. I mean, very superficial, and little was known at that time because they didn't do the observational studies of attachment and babies and all that stuff, and how incredibly important, and I'll review that right now, the attachment with the mother really is. That just wasn't known. Analysis really focused on Oedipal issues, sexual Oedipal stage. So now we have to, if you will, kind of put in this other material and then weave it in. So I'm asking you guys to do something that theoreticians haven't even gotten to yet in a way. And so you have to kind of hold it. And as you get to work longer with patients and get to know this, how this works, you will see this for yourselves and it won't be confusing. I mean, you can see this in some patients where I would still actually diagnose them as a phallic diagnosis in that sense, as in Wright's nomenclature, but I see that they have, okay, they're not a full bore disorder of the self, but they have early issues, early developmental issues regarding the self, and deep abandonment issues. And you know that they may be diagnosed as an hysteric because they're not splitting extensively. But you can see that the self is pretty inadequate in its development. So, and that they have very early attachment problems. But they have a whole enough object that they're not in their splitting and unable to even see you. But Masterson, I think, frankly, would diagnose most of the people that he works with as having disorders of the self. Because if you just pull it out of diagnosis for a second, what is the self? And I'm going to go over this. The self is a high level of functioning. To have a self, to know it, to be able to really express who you are, what you need, without all the stuff in the way, you know, that's a high level of development. I consider the self in the big S development in the genital character is almost parallel. Okay? And so most people that have problems activating the self have early issues. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let me track you through it step by step. Reich really understood the mother and child relationship. It wasn't dominant. And my God, he was doing how much can one man do? I mean, it wasn't that he didn't see this. And Baker, of course, his contribution was to amplify some, a little bit more on the oral and a lot on the ocular. That was Baker's real contribution. And of course, working with the ocular segment is critical. And as Reich said, that's the first 10 days of life. There were attempts to pull all this in, and that's fine. I mean, it's a comprehensive theory in and of itself. But I found that there, when I read Masterson, it just plugged in a gap that I felt needed to be plugged in because I saw it clinically. There was way earlier attachment stuff. And I know that, and a lot of you people are in the attachment business. And it's so exciting. And feel free to share because you guys have the latest and the greatest research. Those of you actually in the field working with mothers and babies. No, this is actually very important because when you actually look, I was saying to you earlier, you know, sometimes when you come to group, I'm just mesmerized. I have to make sure I'm focusing on the interactions because it's so neat just to see a present baby, open. And in the innocence of babies, if you look at this adorable baby, you see the innocence and the openness. Can you see what can happen? I mean, look, it's just wide-eyed and there and present and how quickly painful or contactless interactions can so deeply change that. I mean, I hope that that's obvious to you even as you watch. Yeah. We're not talking in abstraction here. What walks into the office are adult but with little babies inside. And that's what you have to see through. And even though patients are in the office and they're angry or they're this or they're that or they feel misunderstood or they're in pain, you can see backward and know what they went through as to why they're feeling what they're feeling. Sometimes you can see this in young people even who have had really good enough, as we know, good enough mothering, good enough parenting, and you can see the self alive and well, that vitality, that ability to get their needs met, to go forward in their own life, to be close to other people. I mean, it sounds like so much, but in a way it is, and it is, it's our natural birthright, but we get a lot of disturbance before we can ever get there. But then we help patients get there now. So the impact of developmental arrest is significant, as I've just been saying, more than the early analysts realize. And the later research and writing focused on the early attachment events with mother as critical development rather than drives and instincts. So the British Object Relations School, attachment was elevated to a primary drive. Well, that's huge. Where it was all instincts as the primary drive. Now attachment is the primary drive. And boy, that sure makes sense to me in terms of primary drive. That's the dynamic organizer of the self. The self in interaction with the other constituted a relational unit whose aspects become internalized in the form of object relations units. So it's not so much then the ego. I mean, of course it's the id and the ego and the superego, but then you also have an object relations unit. So you move from a one-person psychology to a two- or three-person psychology where you have the object becomes internalized in the form of object relations units. And that's what you then begin to look at. What is in this intrapsychic structure that was internalized, which you see playing out right there with you? You know, you become all of these things to people. You're just sitting there, but you become all of these objects to people, to your patient, as they interact with you, and that gives you insight as to what happened, that they would see you that way, or that you would feel certain ways with them. You would take on projective identification, you would take on their projection and feel that way. This gives you a sense of the drama of the object relations that's internalized.
Welcome to Dr. Frisch's Introduction to Diagnosis, Orgonomy and Character Analysis, Working with Presenting Style and Inroad into Defense, Introductory Course.
I'm going to just do an introduction to the diagnosis, and many of you know these concepts, but how I want you to think about these is this is what you're going to be saying to your patients, you who are orgonomous and moving into that. This is how you're going to be describing your work to your patients. So I want you just to continue to gain mastery of the concepts until they're very fluid for you. And I'm just kind of doing a review of Reich's main concepts so that we continue to start from the foundation. And when you prepare your packets, as a lot of you are working on, you know, that you do a paragraph or two of these basic concepts, even in your packet. If you want to do a separate sheet for body work when you get there, you can present these ideas in your body work page, if you want to do that. So basic theory then, of which his character work came upon, is of course that movement and blocking of energy in the body, as well as the effect of blocking. In other words, that the blocking in the body is what affects the blocking in the personality, if you look at it that way. And in the personality, it manifests in belief systems and ways of being. Again, every time I say it, I always have to say it's a profound concept, because even in this day and age, it's barely understood that our personalities and attitudes and everything have to do with also the way we utilize energy in our biophysical system. And the character includes, because people say, well, what is character? It includes the personality and the entire emotional range, cognitions, attitudes, beliefs, relational style, and defensive structure. So when we're doing what we say character work, look what we're working with here. It's a lot. It's all the way the patient is. And there's no dichotomy between the mind and the body, because the personality and the character is an outgrowth of the energy system and how that works in the body. And of course, Reich called that bioenergy or orgone energy, for organism energy. And that's why it's called orgonomy. So Reich, of course, was unique in that he analyzed character not through the symptoms, which most analysts were doing at that time. They were looking at symptoms. And people still look at symptoms as the way to treat patients. You have depression. You have anxiety. You know, you have an eating disorder. And that's how they treat a patient. You have a mild depression. And that's the major difference of Reich with every practicing therapy, just about, is that they're working to ameliorate symptoms. And yeah, and most therapists are very bright and do history and know to go deep and see, you know, that the patient's more than their symptoms. But still, the symptom carries the full import of understanding the patient. And we'd say that the symptom is only an outgrowth of the character style. So we work with the character in the here and now, how they are in the world, again and again, how they are visibly in your office, in your interactions, every moment of every time you see them. And how they are, what they do. So you don't ignore what you see and feel, but you call it to their attention. And you uncover immediately why they are that way. I mean, it's very powerful work. There's nothing else to do in that session, but uncover why they are that way in the moment with you. Character styles and attitudes are seen as defensive strategies developed early in life as coping mechanisms. And they allow for all those words you learn about in school and analysis. They allow for suppression and repression, denial, all those defenses, avoidance of memory and feeling. How is that done? It's done through the character style, which are the defensive strategies that succeed in then repression, suppression, and all those kinds of defenses. That's how that works. And then the defensive strategies become manifest in the classic defenses, denial, suppression, repression, that are talked about in your analytic programs. Those basic avoidance of affect, really, in all the ways that that's done. So the immediacy of the character brings these strategies to the forefront. And then that's why you want to get your patient to understand what their strategies are. It's very effective.
So that's where they are similar, a lot of the different theories, is that they work with defensive strategies. It's just the how do they work with
them. How do they work with them? Yeah. For instance, I had a patient yesterday, you know, I had been working with her on her running, and I may have mentioned to her before in training, she's so externalized into her husband that she's, and her child at this moment, that she's overly busy and sometimes running. And this came up very, very just immediately in when she started therapy, and we got it so clear. And it was great, but she was still having trouble controlling herself with all, I won't go into all the details of that. But anyway, this week she missed a session. Called up the day of the session, canceled, said, you know, it was a logistical problem. So then she came in the next session, which was Friday, because she rebooked. So the first thing she did, we spent half the session discussing why she canceled her appointment, and that all became clear. And then, you know, kind of closet narcissist situation. Anyway, and then, you know, she told me that she's going to be going on vacation to the East Coast for 3 weeks. And then she said, but I want to have phone sessions because I don't want to be running. Yeah. So this, she said, I don't want to lose connection because I know I do. So here's somebody, this is like her fourth therapy session, I'd say. And has completely gotten a handle on a major character defense. I mean, and I'm just saying that's how it can work. It's like she's now doing her own therapy. So if you get it right at the beginning, then they'll work right with you with it. Now we've tied her running behavior to actually a deeper source of why she's running. And so now she has that, and that's really deepened it for her. But she still will tend to run because, you know, she's appeasing in her relationship and anxious. So we're going deeper with it. Mm-hmm. But she feels the impulse. And now, I mean, she even says, you know, she's feeling the impulse to run from her husband. And we label that as that kind of running behavior. So it just becomes very helpful. and deepens the work fast. That's the point I'm making. If you nail this, it deepens the work fast. This lady would have been out of therapy, frankly, I think, if she had gone to somebody who didn't label that, because she almost quit therapy with me, so that's how I know. That's a tricky thing that we have to work on, is like how to get that comfort zone, that synchrony that we talked about in development, where the patient just senses that you're there with them and you can say pretty straightforward things. That's the art of it, and we're going to keep working on it. And I think as you get stronger with it, you can be more effective. So obviously, to see the character, you have to have incredibly good contact with the patient. So that means you have to be in good contact. And the word contact is so important in Reich's character analytic approach. I mean, that's really critical. And you can think you're in contact, but you're not in contact. But so when you work directly with a patient and you feel yourself alert, then you're in touch with the patient. When you're in contact with the patient, you feel a lot of what the patient feels. That's how you know you're in contact. You can intuit what is going on in the patient, and it helps you know how to intervene. And the contact will bring up a lot of engagement and interaction. And so that's the way Reich worked. He was very engaged. And you flush up the character stance, and then you can utilize the information. Remember, in your contact with the patient is all the information you need. You just have to be present and not, you know, snowed by what they're doing. And then you have to notice the patient's what Reich calls substitute contact, which is that contact coming from the facade that is, or what Masterson would call the false self. The false self is the substitute contact. And you have to, you know, just know that, so a patient can be evasive or habitually upbeat or friendly, and that's a substitute contact. And I dealt with that patient yesterday. She was telling me something serious. She was kind of laughing it off. She's young and cool and hip. And I just, you know, gently called that out. And then she stopped and then went deeper. So you have to constantly work with that.
Welcome to Dr. Frisch's Deepening the Relationship, Working with Dreams, from Additional Audio Courses.
Today we're going to work with dream analysis, which is very, very important in your work with patients. Yet another layer that is so deep and exciting. I have two very robust lectures, and you guys know what it means when I have robust lectures. It means lots of information. I'll try to get through all of it if you can stand it. So I want to, you know, make sure that this gets incorporated, yet another layer of work, into your work with patients, because I feel like that makes the work very, very full when you can do dream analysis. Okay, so let's start with some relevant questions. When do we work with dreams with our patients, and how do we encourage patients to share their dreams? And, of course, much depends on the initial health and defensive structure of the patient. Obviously, if you're working with a disorder of the self patient, and or even phallics, and there's acting out going on and case management issues, the dream work may take a back seat. We have lots to do in the therapy, so we have to kind of pick and choose each session where we go. As you all know by now, well, with the initial phase of treatment, we need to get the patient settled into therapy and get through the initial resistances so that they're contained in the therapeutic relationship. And I want you guys, most of you now, many of you have mastered that well. And those of you that haven't, that's really critical to know how to contain the patient in the therapy and get them settled in and get through lots of, you know, testing and negative transference so that they begin to relax and the therapy is contained. And at that time, you're getting the information, you're forming your diagnosis. And again, underlined, form your diagnosis. Sometimes I notice in case presentations, many of you now, most of you are really working to get to the diagnosis. But I do notice still, I want to emphasize that form the diagnosis, the character diagnosis, because that really tests your skill. One, two, makes you really understand the patient. And you can't work with a patient that you don't understand. And we have a lot of tools around character so that you can understand what you're working with. So form the diagnosis early on, and it can be provisional. So then as the therapy settles in and the patient, you know, relaxes into the work and the testing is somewhat behind you, even though you will have testing all the way through, you've entered into the middle phase of treatment, which I've talked to you all about, and you have a therapeutic alliance, hopefully, and the patient is bringing in their material, they're activating the session, you're still intervening whenever there's defenses, and if there's not defenses, and the patient's activating in their deep work, you can sit back. And at this point, the dream work can take on an additional life in the treatment. And this is not to say that in early phases of therapy, patients, you can do dream analysis, because a patient may very early in therapy bring in a dream, and you would want to take advantage of that, unless you really have something critical on your agenda and don't want to get sidelined. But they can always bring the dream back the next session. And sometimes there's early in therapy, there's very important dreams that actually are therapy dreams and will be very relevant for you because it's their first dream about therapy. So you don't want to miss that. And those are very important dreams because it's very important when a patient starts therapy. And their unconscious will be involved in that decision and in that process. Patients where their outer life is extremely demanding, a symptom of that is that they won't have dreams. Mm-hmm. And many phases in life, we have dreams, and many phases in life, we don't remember our dreams. But patients who are way externalized into their outer life or have huge stresses in their outer life, those patients, you'll notice they don't have an inner life and an inner connection to their dreams. By the way, other patients who are very disconnected from their inner world, some who have amnesia about their early history, will tend to be disconnected from their psyche and never dream. So you'll begin to notice who dreams and who doesn't and when. But I think that the ability to dream and remember your dreams shows a relationship to your unconscious, which is really important. And I'll say more about that. But we want the unconscious speaking to us. And we want to learn from this source that is, as Jung said, the objective psyche, which is autonomous. It's autonomous in its communications and as an entity. And so we can achieve guidance and really important messages from the unconscious. And to Jung, it was his spirituality. His relationship to his unconscious was like his direct relationship to God. And I'll say more about that, because it's the God within, and it's, you know, that's the beauty of Jung's approach, is that we can, as people, rely on ourselves to understand where we're going by listening to our unconscious. We don't have to go outside to necessarily. We have it all inside. Most of you know that I encourage patients to listen to their, right away, first session, second session, I tell patients to have by a dream journal, record their dreams, tell their psyche to dream, and bring that into their life, and periodically I will ask them if they're dreaming. so that they know the door is open for them to share dreams and to begin to listen to dreams. And I explain to them that it's an opening, you know, dreams let them know what is happening at a deeper level than they may want to realize in their ego. So it's a different source of information from conscious thinking and feeling. And I encourage that. And there are patients that are afraid to dream, because patients with trauma are afraid to dream. They often have nightmares or very bad images, or they barely remember their dreams, but they don't feel good when they wake up. And they feel on edge or anxious. And these patients are often very frightened to dream. And you need to reassure them that with their communication with their unconscious, they can weather what they need to look into and not run from it in fear. So if a patient brings in a dream and I want to work on that dream in that session, and there's not something important that I want to work on, and you know that I tell you that sometimes if something happens the prior session or there's a resistance or there's something important, I will go back to that. So I'm not necessarily going to just jump into a dream if there's something important to complete with a patient's defensive structure or some acting out they've done or whatever. But, you know, then normally if a patient brings in a dream, I might think that that's a good time to work in it. But I will ask them, before we get into the dream, I will check in with them, and because I want to know the context of their feelings and life at the moment, so I can establish resonance with them before we go into the dream, so you don't go into the dream cold. And I'll, you know, start with some communication just about the, you know, what's going on with the patient, because dreams are usually recent that they bring in. So naturally, when you're working on a dream, you want to be more in your right brain communication, which we've talked about. You know what that is. So when you're working dreams, you're entering, you know, a liminal space, the betwixt and between, where you enter in with no reference points. And that's a state of flux. You're capturing a state of flux between dimensions of consciousness. It's really quite profound. And Jung uses the terms, you know, luminous, luminosity, numinous. And it defines this otherworldly nature of dream language and dream experience. So these terms connote a filled with light quality that comes through dreams. And it's some, you know, these altered states, if you will, are sometimes there when you're with someone who's dying, you know, when you're with someone who's close to someone who's dying, when you're with a birth sometimes, or deep processes where things are broken down, you begin to see these more altered states of consciousness. And it's that place that you're entering into dream life, because you need access to these dimensions. So as you work with the associations of the patient or friend, whoever you're working with dreams, you know, you're working that part of the brain and you're keeping your cognition a bit at the background. But, of course, you also want to keep the patient, the totality, the patient in your consciousness. So you want to keep the character patterns and the adaptive strengths and weaknesses, and you want to keep in mind where the patient's growth edge is. It's interesting, you work with both a comprehensive understanding of the patient, but also your own cognitions in the background, so that you can achieve a more right brain state of consciousness. So I'm going to review some of the themes. Some of you have learned and some of you not, but we'll go through those just so you have them. You know, Jung's concept of individuation, that was his focus. He used the term individuation that makes the middle phase of therapy, you know, very challenging and rewarding. But if you really work the more spiritual levels with the patient, you don't need to use that term, and that when they're in the middle phase, this is what keeps people able to sustain staying in therapy. Because if you don't grasp what the journey is in its biggest way, then you're going to lose the patient. And the goal here is not to keep the patient for the sake of keeping the patient, but you have to be able to understand the vastness of this journey. And the journey is not just adaptation or ego adaptation or good relationships or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the case management stuff, all the character work. This is then moving to what Wright called the genital character or the authentic self or the individuated self, what Jung talked about, which then begins to move into the spiritual or meaningful or deep places that a life can go. So that's the journey that I want you to understand. And many therapists don't experience that in their life, so they can't guide the patient past a certain point. And the patient loses interest in therapy, has no idea what individuation is, and, you know, stops. Sometimes, and I'll say more about this later, but when patients experience symptoms that may look like dread or emptiness or lack of meaning or despair, even if their life is kind of okay, these can be very deep issues of loss of meaning and alienation. And you have to understand the big picture of a person's life that not everybody can go there, but many people actually, even though they don't understand the words, when you say the words to them, it begins to ring for them that is my life more than what just meets the concrete, what meets the eye. And if you embody this, then you have the whole journey in your own being, and it's that then the patient can learn from you. And then you add this whole work to their life.
Welcome to Dr. Frisch's Talionic Impulse Intermediate CD Course.
Okay, Talionic Impulse. This is just a wonderful concept in the Masterson group and with Masterson. One of his earlier important concepts from working with the borderline. And I am going to speak more about the borderline today in relationship to this. But narcissists have this too. And, you know, very much so. So you will recognize what this is. This is an important concept when you feel frustrated by a patient's tenacious resistance, because this can be what is going on. You know, their resistance to getting better. And we witness this relentless self-destructiveness repeatedly without regards to consequences. And this is the talionic impulse at play. So talion means punishment same as crime. Punishment same as crime.
Is the same as?
Same as crime, yeah.
Same as crime.
Yeah. In other words, as Masterson said, the deepest and most ancient of human impulses to exact revenge by taking pleasure in inflicting on others the hurt one has experienced. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. So if you think about those words and those feelings, this is a very deep human process that's in our DNA and in our karma and in our lineage. And I'll say more about the world today and how that manifests. And this is something that is in most, if not all of us, to some degree. To the extent that we don't feel personal power in some areas, we will want to exact revenge, and we won't even know that we're actually doing it. it's can be subtle. It can be overt, but it can be very, very subtle. Because if you have a lot of layers of facade, of compliance, and of nice guy, and of various other things, or just acting out rage, you're not going to realize that you're stuck in your rage because it's really talionic. So an understanding of the origin and purpose of this impulse helps to explain why mastery, you know, is important. The child, particularly a borderline, because of the deprivation, feels helpless to protect himself, right, against suffering. So he stores the pain, which brings with it a resolve. And I mean, people tell you this, never to permit this passive acceptance of pain again. Kids make decisions all the time, and adults remember that they made decisions, that they won't let themselves feel this ever again. Instead, the fantasy of paying back the real or imagined perpetrator when one gets older is evoked. Yeah, so they make the resolve, and then the fantasy is the payback. Of course, that payback then comes to friends, spouses, and to you. So you resolve that you're not going to accept this suffering anymore, but the fantasy is, I'm going to get back. When you're young and you feel humiliated, you can feel shamed, you can feel completely controlled by a belligerent, sadistic parent, you can feel, I mean, not to mention all the abuse that people have, verbal and physical abuse, but being unrecognized, many, many things happen where you accept it passively. Because what are you going to do as a kid?
Yeah.
You don't have power. And particularly if you don't act out a lot of rage when you're young, you store that, and then there's a feeling of, I'm going to get back. And one can see the getting back in adolescence, and one can see the getting back even earlier. I mean, you got young children with guns and stuff. I mean, but even if it's not that dramatic, you have to look inside at your own talionic impulse to get back and to act out. And in it, you can see it in cold, narcissistic rage. You can see it in, you know, borderline acting out of defiance, active resistance, active revenge. And this is the way that the past is undone, in the sense of undoing, an attempt to undo the past. So instead of the person being weak and helpless, a passive object, the individual is strong, active, and netting out just punishment for the trauma. And I mean, when you're in the room with somebody actively doing this, that's what it feels like. They are strong and active, and they're really putting it out there. And it's ugly. So this talionic impulse, it seeks immediate release without regard for the consequences or effect on the future or long-term objectives. I thought about how would Reich see this? Well, he could label it a psychopath, but that's an extreme version. Also, the impulsive character, he discussed the impulsive character, where there's impulsivity, but sometimes that doesn't necessarily need a revenge component. That's one of the ways that one would get back with a talionic impulse, okay, is to inhibit other people's freedom. But there's other aspects to it that are more psychological or psychodynamic that are manifesting interpersonally and intrapsychically.
Welcome to Dr. Frisch's Schizoid, A Deeper Look, Advanced CD Course.
So I will begin with a discussion of schizophrenia. So when we look at schizophrenia from an organomic perspective, there are differences in how the type is viewed. So when we glance at schizophrenia as differentiated from the Masterson group, I want you to begin to understand the two ways that schizophrenia is seen in orgonomy. And schizophrenia and schizoid, of course, are on the same spectrum. And so they have many similarities in character defenses as well as their intrapsychic structure. So within ergonomy, there are clinicians who see schizophrenia as a separate character type. They realize that most of these patients cannot be assessed as neurotic and lumped into phallic level assessment. Now, in the Masterson group, schizophrenia is also seen as a unique personality disorder. And it's not lumped into the schizoid or simply referenced by descriptors from the DSM. So here we're starting to see now a parallel. We have the Masterson group seeing the schizophrenic as a personality disorder. And we have Reich, of course, and elements in current Reichian thinking that schizophrenia is separate, a separate character. So you can see that schizophrenia continues to hold its own place setting at the table as a very unique character disorder. So my belief is that there is a non-phallic schizophrenic character disorder seen by ergonomists, and that is compatible with the Masterson group definition of schizophrenic personality disorder. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
And remember that both Reich and Masterson share the same perspective, that there's an overriding character structure that includes intrapsychic, behavioral, feeling, interpersonal expression of the patients. So that's why they're so compatible together, because they're not looking at symptoms. They're looking at the whole way the person is, which is what we've learned from Reich. And then as we continue to learn Reich's typology and integrate a developmental, multifactorial approach, we can really sharpen our lens and see what contributes to diagnosis. So I'm going to start here with a phallic level schizophrenic. So there's a non-phallic level schizophrenic and a phallic level schizophrenic. There can be schizophrenics that one defines as neurotic, which is kind of the more classic ergonomic stance that has now been changing. Because as you know, they lumped everybody into neurotic, and not everybody makes it to neurotic. So, but now let's talk about the neurotic schizophrenic that we would see in practice. Their level of ego development is consistent with neurosis rather than earlier developmental arrest. And they're fairly functional and integrated in society. But you may notice that they're chronically confused as a defense, and they have a predominance of fear. And they also seem disconnected from their bodies. They don't recognize sensations. So they'll talk about sensations, but the sensations don't mean anything, have no meaning. They're also, of course, armored in the brain. And they have ocular armor. And they invariably have throat armor. You'll hear that immediately in the way they sigh. And they have splitting because they sometimes view themselves and others oddly because they have that ocular block and not clear perception. And they tend to have, you know, lower vegetative energy because they have armoring in the brain centers that affect the breathing capacity. And so you'll often see kind of a minimized breath. They obviously have less need for body armor because their brain is so armored. And so you'll often see that softer body type in the schizophrenic. but they have fairly good reality testing and whole object relations. So you could, if you didn't see too much splitting in that person, good and bad object relations stuff, you could diagnose them as a schizophrenic, phallic schizophrenic. Many schizophrenics obviously have a rest earlier, and they should not be considered as phallic schizophrenics. It really would be a misdiagnosis. And that's confirmed with orgonomy. Schizophrenics are impacted during the first 10 days, according to Wright, because of the ocular block. But that doesn't mean they could have some blocking in their eye in the first 10 days and then sail fairly well through to the genital phase or get bumped in what I'm going to talk about in the first few months because they don't differentiate. So you see, there are many factors, and this is the point I'm going to be emphasizing today, many, many factors to how a person is diagnosed, not just one or not just two. So the ones that shouldn't be seen as neurotics have some similarities and differences with schizoid, and that's where it gets kind of tricky to diagnose.
Welcome to Dr. Frisch's live coaching on therapeutic interventions for couples therapy.
Let's put the couple here and the therapist here.
Oh, therapist here.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Good. First of all, sometimes when I do couple work, as you guys, some of you know, when it's the first session, what I like to do is kind of give a little introduction to the work and ask whether they've had couple therapy or not. And then also, it's very nice, I like to open some space and say, you know, this is an opportunity to be open and honest with everything that's going on, and that this is a chance to really speak to things that have been troubling you in the relationship. So I kind of give a little introduction so the couple can kind of get a sense of what direction I'm going to move in, and I'm going to tell them that I'm going to want them to be talking to each other more than to you, although there may be times that they will inevitably talk to you, but that it's about facilitating their communication together. Yeah. Okay.
So welcome. We're glad to see you too. Generally, we have the room set up so that you can face each other. We'll be talking primarily with each other and also with us. If you could change your...
Excellent. So you took charge immediately and set the structure. But I'll just move right along with what comes to mind. But what did you notice that they did do?
It took a heat. What needed to cue to move. And there was a not moving initially.
Right. How did you guys set up the chairs initially?
They were facing each other.
Okay. So no. what did they do?
It was diagnostic. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They moved.
Yeah.
They structured the environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So right away, even before you do your prelude, if you wanted, you could make an intervention on your immediate observation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because that's what happened in the room, and that immediately brings something up. So you could try that to see what happens. You want to?
Okay. So you change the seats which were set up before, you know, so that, you know, I set up a chair so that you can see each other, but you change a chair so that you don't need to see each other. I just wonder what happened. You came in and then changed the seats.
I just thought it wasn't set up right. I thought it was a mistake. And I just assumed that I needed to talk to you folks. That's what, why we're here, I thought. But this is okay.
This is okay?
Mm. It's interesting you thought that it was a mistake.
Yeah, I guess that was a mistake.
So who's owns the mistake there?
Wow. I guess I do. You wanted it this way, and I came in and changed it.
I don't want to say, I don't want to put you off, but I do want to make observations of what I see in your behavior and your, how you are with each other. And that's part of what the work we'll be doing together, is noticing these kinds of things and asking to highlight them and focus on them.
That's excellent. That's really good work. Now, that smoothed it over enough, but you could make a, you could ask her whether that is stylistic for her.
You find yourself aware of things in your environment that aren't quite right or that need to be shifted or changed. Sounds like you have a response to my question to Diane.
She often is like that. You know, takes control of things, got to be a certain way.
Yeah. That's what he says, is that I often just try to control too much.
We'll be getting to the heart of one of the pieces of things that you'd like to change.
Well, I just feel like I have to because you're so passive.
Well, yeah, that's true, and I mean, I've learned from experience that even if I try something, it doesn't get a response necessarily, or get respect for what I want to do. And I sometimes feel like that you know, even if I were to be more proactive in this relationship, I'm afraid that you're pretty much not going to take it seriously anyway.
So what's happening over here with him? What's he saying when he says that?
Well, there's a sense that he can't get anything right.
Right.
And that is going to let him know when he has it wrong.
So, but be careful here, because right now you just want to focus on him. You got a sense a bit of her, but what do you need to get a sense of with him? Yeah, he feels like he can't do it right. And what else is going on in his character? That his style.
Gives up.
Oh, all right.
Why bother?
The passive
advice.
Well, I heard that he wants approval. You know, he's waiting for permission to be. Okay, so, you know, you got to call that stuff out right away, just so each person knows what you're seeing. Then you can kind of sort out the system.
Thank you. So it seems like you need approval from your wife.
Well, yeah, it would be nice to, you know, be in agreement every now and then. Be a good thing.
So you always look at how expressions, facial expression, and see if it's right or that's.
Look at me and her. Look at her facial expressions.
Yeah.
She's very demonstrative with her expressions, and I can tell before I even say a word. I can tell where she's coming from or what she's gonna, how she's gonna respond. Or so it's just sometimes when I just let her have her way.
She wants to assert herself, take control. And I've just learned, it seems like it's the wisest thing to let her just do whatever she's going to do. As opposed to trying to, you know, I don't feel like there's space for me to really say.
So you give up your own needs or what you want, and so just follow what your wife is thinking or wanting?
Yeah. It's true.
So here, you know, you can, and soon you'll get them really hashing this out, but you're kind of getting it deeper, faster than if you did nothing, but let them start bickering and scrambling. You're kind of setting already, you've got the character stuff here now, you've got the stylistic structure set up, and now you could get to some feeling in the room. So he says this, so, but how is it really for him that he does this? I mean, he seems very comfortable with this stance.
Kind of sad. You look sad.
Well, now, I wouldn't feed him a feeling. I would make him work.
Sounds like you have a sense of what happens between the two of you.
Uh-huh.
How does it feel? Like, how is it feeling right now in the room, sitting, looking at each other?
I feel exhausted. I feel a little hopeless. I feel like, why bother? I feel like, is it worth it anymore?
I just wonder, you can say that by looking at her directly, and you can say that?
Again? I feel like that. I feel like you don't respect me. I feel like that you don't take what I have to say seriously. That even when you pretend to do so, that within moments you tend to negate, or you tend to go the other direction from what we're just talking about.
I go in the other direction?
Well, it's like we never had a conversation to begin with. It's like when we talk about something and we come to an agreement. The agreement doesn't hold water. That you ultimately, you're going to do whatever you're going to do it, and you're going to do it your way, and no matter how much I chime in, you'll always, in the end, do it your way, and then get my permission or my cooperation afterwards.
Really? Mm. That's not my experience at all. I think we go over things. I think we reach a decision that maybe we're not clear on it. Maybe we don't have the agreement, but I don't. It's not my experience at all. I think we have real clear understanding of things, and then I see you just back off, and you don't hold up your end.
So this is what normally would happen, which is fine, because, you know, you can let it play out a little to get to really see what's happening. But you do want to at some point get them to listen, at least to understand what the other's saying. Because if one person says something and the other person disagrees and discounts it, you're kind of back to square one because nothing's been absorbed. So two things came up for me. One is, of course, to work with how she discounts him instantly. But also, this is a little extreme intervention, but it's something like this, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you know what I mean by that? He's like, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's just talking. Helpless, yay. Hopeless, there's no, you know, he's saying all the words, but he's really emotionless and kind of...
Yeah, you answered emotional.
Did you?
Hmm?
Oh, okay, well, what could have been.
I saw some emotion.
Just now?
No.
Oh, during the...
Yeah.
Did you have any?
I think I was feeling sad.
Okay.
Is that what you saw?
Mm. Okay. That's good.
Exhausted, sad.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's go with that. But let's see first about what happened with, as her response to him after he said what he said.
Do we need to like summarize or clarify that yes, there's a gap?
Not yet. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
That's a good question, though, and sometimes you would, but I don't think so yet.
Okay. I was talking about his experience and wondering how much of that you were able to take in and hear what he said to you.
How much? So what? You want me to tell you what I heard?
Yeah, that would be... What did you hear him say about his experience with you?
He thinks we make decisions and then I don't stick by him. Mm-hmm. And then I go off and do my own thing.
Mm-hmm. Ask her if there's truth to that.
Is there truth to that?
Well, there might be sometimes when we start doing something and I realize, you know, there's a better way to organize it or something. So, you know, just naturally, because, you know, start one thing leads to another, and then, you know, he fades away and I'm left doing it. And so, yeah, I'll do it the way I feel like it's
that sounds
proper
like,
to do.
Like a pattern that you have between the two of you. Where you'll think you have an agreement with each other, you'll start working it, then you'll shift it a bit, you find, as you say, a better way, and then you're left feeling what? That?
Well, the flip side of, the other side of her feeling it's, she's doing it her way, and that's the best way, is that whatever way I was suggesting ends up being pretty much ignored and not taken seriously. And after when that happens, I just as soon withdraw. Go play music or go do something else and relax.
That's, I think, interesting, like, because you feel she's ignoring you, your needs, but you feel like he's fading away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ships in the night.
Yeah. It's really like that.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I kind of have to pick up the slack a lot of times, you know. You could become just kind of this dead weight or something, and I'm pulling you along and trying to manage the house. And
well, that's, I can see why you think like that, but you know, sometimes I wish you'd just come home and relax. Just, you don't have to do anything. I have no expectations.
So he's so reasonable. Can you feel when the energy drains out? Watch the energy. I don't even listen to the words. I watch the energy that's happening in the couple. And there was a moment they could have touched.
Yeah.
Did you?
Well, with the ships in the night.
Yeah.
What might bring the ships together?
Well, that's too soon.
Yeah.
But that was a moment. And they quickly moved away from that moment.
Oh, yeah.
So number
and then
one,
right into changing the subject.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was a moment, because I was wondering if that was her contempt. It seemed
it was
so
contempt. It was contempt, but there was a moment in my feeling.
And I didn't see her, and maybe there was a whole.
It was just a place, a little pause where they could have met, or you know, but they quickly moved away from that. Yeah. One, always see a moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Always see a moment, and when the diversion is. The other thing, watch when the energy drains out, which is usually when they bypass a moment, and then watch how the energy drains out. So he goes in his head. Don't listen to the words totally. He's in his head, and she and here I would bring it more out. Because they're low key, with a bickering, raging couple, you don't. But they're kind of tired out with each other. So you've got to really get more going.
Mm-hmm.